Welcome everyone to FinTech Mavericks Live right here at Money 2020 at Las Vegas. I'm your host, Nicole Casperson, author, journalist, founder, and CEO of FinTech is Femme.
And I'm Drew Glover, founder of Fiat Growth and co-founder of Fiat Ventures.
Love it. Today, we are thrilled to be joined by Grima Shah, co-founder and president of Biller Genie, a company transforming one of the least sexy parts of fintech, invoicing. Biller Genie automates accounts receivable for small and mid-sized businesses. Think landscapers, mechanics, florists, the real backbone of our economy. And what she's built is proof that discipline and focus beat hype every single time. Grima, welcome to FinTech Mavericks.
Thanks so much for having me. And I kind of think we are sexy, all right?
Yes, yes.
Convince us. You will convince us. Well, I think we're in an era where we are, where the pivot for, you know, investors and even just the sheer attention of our industry is getting kind of going back to those basics of the unsexy parts. Like after the everyone made an investing app wave, I think we're like back in this arena. So, okay, we'll get into that. For first question for you, Grima, you're solving, you know, one of the most just painful problems in finance. As a business owner myself, I am well aware of this pain point. Where did that obsession for you start? Was there like a moment where you realize this is a problem I have to solve?
I wish I could say that I had that aha moment. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to solve this problem. It's going to be a huge company. It wasn't like that. We're payments people. We were trying to build a payments company, realized that there was a need in order to, you know, connect payments and ERP software. There wasn't really a way to do that. So that's what we built. And in building that, we realized that, oh my gosh, this is such a bigger pain point. And the average US business, it's 47 to 50 days to get paid on invoice. And we realized on our software, we can get them paid in 7 or 8. And that just changes everything. It changes everything for small businesses.
And what was it about from a go-to-market strategy? You kind of focusing on, yes, we're calling them these unsexy verticals. That was like your go-to-market wedge in terms of really standing the business up and starting to get it going from a momentum standpoint.
No one talks about them. No one creates products for Main Street USA, or very few people do. People are always creating stuff for enterprise and large. I mean, there's been AR automation systems like YayPay and HighRadius and all of that for years up in the enterprise space. But you look at the small business owner who's literally wearing all hats. I mean, you guys both know your founders. We're wearing every hat. I just told you. Someone's asking about scratches on a couch, right? So we wear all these hats. And as a small business founder, having to get your invoices paid is just another one of those. And so if we can help those people out, I think that that really changes what we do.
64% of SMBs deal with delayed payments. That is pretty much messing up with the economy's survival, right? Like that is a huge impact. So what does solving that look like at scale? Tell us like a little bit more about how Biller Genie works. Yeah.
Super simple. So we again, small businesses, we are very founder first and very like, how do we actually help a small business? If you tell a small business owner, if you tell any of us, hey, we have a great product, you're going to go learn a whole new software. You're going to change your entire workflow. You'll be like, yeah, that sounds great. Let me add it to my 100th item on my priority list. So instead, we're using systems that they already know. So they already use QuickBooks. They already use Xero. They already use these accounting platforms. And we're just an extension of, and we're saying, hey, it's set it and forget it. Go in. Do everything you did on QuickBooks your whole life, hit save, we'll take over. And then we handle the entire AR process as if, think of us like a outsourced AR company or assistant. And we just handle everything on the back end so that that small business owner can focus on what they do best, whether that's landscaping or wholesale t-shirts or whatever it is that they do that makes them so great as a business owner.
That's awesome. And in terms of how you kind of sell the product, are you selling a lot through larger partners like a QuickBooks, or are you going direct to the small business?
We actually don't do anything direct. It's all through partnerships, yep. But not partnerships with QuickBooks because we're payments people.
Of course.
All of our partnerships are actually with large banks, financial institutions, and processors. So here at Money 2020, all of our partners are here. So whether it's the huge acquirers and processors or the very large banks, the top 6 banks in the US use us, as well as all of the top processors.
Very cool. Yeah, and obviously one of the bigger reasons why you don't see a lot of businesses solving for these backbone type of verticals is because they're not the ones that you see marketing because they don't have the marketing budget. So you really have to like search to get in front of them. And that is typically a huge cost from a marketing standpoint. So you guys going from this B to B to C go to market strategy put you in such a an advantageous position to be able to scale. Like you get five or six of those partners and your business is booming.
Absolutely. We've been super lucky to not have to have a marketing arm actually ever, or not yet. And we don't have a cost of acquisition. So it makes it a much easier business to scale.
Very cool.
Not easy, but it makes it a business that we can scale.
Yeah. And so just to double click on that, because obviously when you're going the partnership route, once you get one of those partnerships completed, the next hard part is actually activating your product within one of these large banks. Can you just talk a little bit more about how you are turning this partnership into something that is truly active and turning into a huge revenue source for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say commercialization activation is the most, like, the most important thing. So you hit the nail on the head. And it's really all about education. At the end of the day, the last person, the salesperson who's selling that account, the person at the bank, the teller, the one who is dealing with that small business owner, it's, do they know that this product is in their toolkit? Do they know how much it's going to affect the small business owner that they're working with? Do they understand how it's going to change their story? So our goal is really training focused. Yeah. So how can we be in front of as many sales managers, as many territory managers, treasury managers, and how can we really teach them the benefit and to find the right type of customer? You know, for Bill or Jeannie, that would be a great fit for both sides. It also reduces their attrition. I mean, we know what average industry attrition is. Our attrition on most of our plans is sub 5% annually.
Wow. That's awesome. Mm. That's really awesome.
Mm. Talk to us about some of the results that you've seen from the folks that do use Bill or Jeannie.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, like there's so many examples, but the one that I think of a lot is we had this Indian reservation, and you guys can think about like an Indian reservation charging $8 for power. Mm-hmm. He had $800,000 outstanding. So 100,000 outstanding invoices. And he's like, what am I even, am I supposed to call these people? Like what am I supposed to do? We turned on Bill or Jeannie for him, and within 24 hours he'd collected $400,000. And these invoices, some of them were like a year, 2 years old, because think about it. It's not that someone was trying to dodge him on an $8 invoice. Like that wasn't what was happening. It was just, they forgot that they owed it. They left and they left, like they forgot. And then it wasn't easy to pay. And then they had to find a check and a postage stamp. And it was just too hard. So they didn't make the payment. When they got that email, they're like, oh my God, I need to pay this. Let me just pay really quick. That's what happened. And we see that over and over again.
And so can we talk a little bit more about the user experience? Because obviously, historically, you get mail and people just throw mail away. The next thing you know, someone's calling you. No one answers. No one's looking at messages anymore, like voicemail messages, text messages. If you don't know the number, you're just not going to respond to it. So I'm assuming, like, as you're following up and you're creating this really strong relationship with whoever you're trying to, like, you know, get some of these bills paid for, what is that journey? How are you utilizing technology to kind of sift through people just not responding?
Yeah, I mean, this sounds crazy, but email is actually the best format of all of that. Mm-hmm. So they're getting invoices via email, but they're also getting it in the brand of the customer that they've bought something from. So it's not coming from QuickBooks. It's not coming from So Name or No Reply. It's coming from Joe Landscaper with his color, his information. So that's really, really important in that process. We're also launching some agentic AI tools, which are going to be making outbound calls on behalf of those customers as well for really delinquent payments, so that way we can help, you know, with more than one method. So right now we do paper mail, email, and we're adding agentic AI. But I agree with you. We were looking at the text route for a long time, and text just gets deleted for the most part and not listened to or looked at as much as some of these other, you know, mediums.
Email is the way. I believe in that wholeheartedly as a newsletter writer. I kind of want to talk about just like some of your growth strategy, especially early on. So Graham and I have had lunch at some point together in the past, where we pretty much, you had a lot of amazing takes just on being, you know, a founder, being in that growth mode, when to take money from an investor, when to not. So I want to get into some of that for the founders that listen to our show. You've said to me when we met last, if you're building a company just for an exit, you're building the wrong company. That is these days a bold take, because everyone is kind of just like obsessed with valuations and unicorn status and like having that, in, you know, dreamy exit, if you will. Talk to us about your mindset around that, like building Bill or Jeannie. Obviously what you're building, it's like a no question. It's a need. It's a necessity. Like business is good because of this. The communicating that though, to people, to investors, it's different, a whole different story, right?
Absolutely. Well, so let's start with your first question. I think, when should a founder take money? never if you don't have to.
Yeah.
Right. I think that one of those things, when you take money from anybody, even if it's your best friend or your parents, there's always some kind of responsibility or an obligation that comes along with that money.
Mm-hmm.
And some of your decision-making, some of your governance, some of all of those things you're doing start going away. Your total independence starts dwindling away the more money you take. And look, taking money is great. We've done Series A. We've done mostly through friends and family. We're thinking about potentially going institutional at some point, but it's only because we already have a growth strategy that's scalable and that's working, and we know exactly where we're putting that money. But when I say don't build for just having a cool valuation, you see these founders that just start building and they get on this treadmill of growth and they get on this treadmill of like raising money every year. All you're doing then is pitching and board decks and everything else just to raise more money.
Mm.
And then you keep raising money, and then the people that you're raising from want you to deploy that money. So they want you to, as fast as possible, deploy that money, get it out there, spend it just so you go raise more. And by the end of it, I mean, a founder's left with almost virtually no equity and no decision-making power in their own business. And it's really just poised to sell. And it's sometimes a shell of a company. I mean, we've seen this happen over and over again where these massive valuations happen. And then all of a sudden you have hundreds and hundreds of people laid off and your whole company changes. Like, what are we really building for? So is it really about having the biggest company, the biggest valuation, or is it about making the most money and protecting value? And I think those are two almost completely diametrically opposed things.
Mm-hmm.
I 100% agree. I mean, obviously, I'm an investor, but I'm what the market would call a power law investor, where I'm only investing in what I believe to be generational businesses. It just so happens that most generational businesses truly do need to have some level of investment from a VC, because a lot of them are operating at a deficit because they are trying to scale just as quickly as they're trying to drive revenue. And a lot of times scale and revenue don't go side by side. But I always ask, you know, because I say no to 99% of the pitches that I get. And a lot of the questions are, you know, what is your end goal here? Because you might have a business that is a great lifestyle business, or you might have a business that can get really great revenue. But at the same time, that business is one that is scaling at a point where, you know, it might not be generational, but the impact it can make is it's outsized. And so I guess the question back to you is, I'm the biggest believer in there being somebody ringing the bell to go public that has never raised money. That is like a huge story that I hope one day is told. But from your perspective, are you looking to build a public company? Or are you looking to like impact a very small subset of individuals? What is your end goal?
I would say public, just with the legality around that. I'm not so sure that that sounds so sexy.
Yeah.
But no, I think that, look, we're building a large business because it's what's happening,
yeah,
right? And we're scaling, and we're almost at 80 people right now. We're pretty large in terms of our growth and our revenue numbers.
Incredible.
And it's, you know, it's only been 5 years and we've doubled or tripled every single year, right? So I think that that's going to continue, and we're definitely going to build a very large company. And at some point, I'm sure we'll be an acquisition target. I think that is every founder's goal, to be able to do those things. I don't think this is a lifestyle business. And in terms of you being an investor or anybody, I'm an investor as well.
Of course.
I think that it's great to be an investor. It's great to take money, but it should be smart money.
I agree.
And it needs to be the money that's going to actually help you propel you to the, like, it should be jet fuel. It should be the thing that gets you there. And you should know, like, hey, this is my, you know, use of funds. Like, I see pitch decks, I'm sure you do too, where you ask them, like, what's the use of capital? And it's like, oh, we're just going to build really cool things. And it's like, well, what? Like, how are you actually making revenue? How do you expect to monetize whatever you're doing? And sometimes the revenue or the money is used for really basic things. Like, maybe you need a better team around. You need to hire people. You need to pay for marketing that you're not going to see that revenue for in a while because the cycle takes too long. Like, those are perfectly normal things that people should raise for. It's just when people raise in like the Uber, WeWork phenomenon of like, let me just raise to raise and overpay for things because I'm going to pay for the revenue.
Yeah.
I think that that just outsizes the market.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the media has a massive role to play in that. When I would sitting behind the scenes in newsrooms, I mean, it's the main thing that they're after, right? It's why there's the headlines. It's you know, it's very glamorized because of the narratives we put out there. The more money you raise, the more likely you are to be successful. And that's just not true. Like, that's just not a narrative we should really be glorifying and following all the time. It should be more strategic about, oh, they raised this much to do what with it? And then you can kind of get that out of, you know, a founder, but they can't make too many promises, all of that. Like, it just, to me, it's gotten like a little wonky and a little messy in terms of like the consistency of the narrative we put out there in media, that raising is like this, the only...
It's a signal.
It's a signal, but it's like this success metric that we are so obsessed with. And it, which then forces us to pretty much constantly only write about one kind of person, one kind of company. And so you're missing just like a massive breadth, a massive level of like diversity in terms of who you could be learning about.
I agree. I 100% agree. I also feel like we should take a second and just like give you your flowers, because what you're doing is very rare. I think it's an important stat to just state, like 90% of the companies that I invest in that are pre-seed or seed, the product that they go to market with is not the product that I invested in. And that's because they have to constantly shift and iterate on their business. And not everyone is, and I'm not assuming that you just like had an idea and it all just like turned into this product. I'm sure you had your moves throughout the way, but a lot of really great founders make really expensive mistakes. And that sometimes involves them having to fundraise, or at least having the cushion to fundraise again. The unfortunate thing is once you fundraised once or twice, to your point, there's people on your board, you are too deep in the game to not have to lead that process for the foreseeable future. And if you try to go against it, then a lot of times you're having people that are getting really mad at you that have invested a lot of money. And so you kind of early on need to make the decision, like, am I fundraising or am I not? Because you have the ability right now to build with freedom.
Very much so.
Incredible.
But I would also say that, you know, it's been awesome to be able to do this. But I think a lot of that is also we're old founders, right? Like, I'm not 20 years old right out of college.
Yeah.
I'm old, right? I've been doing this for 20 years.
I'm old.
And so I think that changes things, because it allows us to bootstrap. We've been in this space for a long time. We understand how a general ledger works. We understand how to look at a P&L. And I would say that's what I think about when I look at new founders. I don't think that financial literacy is taught enough.
Agreed.
And no idea on like, what does equity really mean? What does it mean if I lose this? What is dilution? I mean, just all of those basic things that by the time most founders learn about it, they're like three rounds in. And that's really scary. Like, we should be teaching founders, especially young founders, how a business works. They could have great ideas, and that's awesome, and people want to invest in that. That's so cool. But you take a 22-year-old right out of college who's never worked in a company, who's never done anything financial, never run a business segment. They have a cool idea, and all of a sudden they're running this business, and they're raising money from people who do this a million times a year, VC and PE-backed firms, and of course, well, you got lawyers all around.
Yeah,
you.
Or they have the right connection or the right whatever. They barely have they have like a kernel idea of a product, and they'll raise like a few million dollars and then hire a bunch of people. And then eventually, to show that they're using the money, they have to like
burn
exactly, and then right. Fire them all. So I guess like for me, I just like want I would love to see that cycle just start to dwindle, if not completely go away, in a sense.
But you said it.
It won't.
It's glorifying. But you said it.
It
you
won't.
Said it. Media glorifies it. I mean, like I was whining at you because I was telling you that I was so mad at a news outlet. Forbes had done this list of like the next unicorns. And if you looked at that list, it came out like 2 months ago. And the first stat was amount that they raised. And then it was like 80 million, 100 million. There's all these companies. And it said like 2024 revenue. The vast majority were under $2 million, under $1 million, half a million. I'm sorry, half a million, zero revenue. And you're just like, and you've raised 80 million. What is happening? Like, when did we get so backward? Like, when did we? And like, and it's like, oh my God, this is so exciting. Like, and you're like, what? I'm sorry. Like, that's not how business works. Like,
it's true.
Yeah. So then if we're never going to get out of the hype cycle, what do we do, Drew?
What are
you going to do about it?
I'll just say, I think we all know this. You know, there are a couple like very large VCs out there. There's a lot of news outlets. We've romanticized venture like for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I will also say that there's a lot of big players that invest today that also own a lot of news outlets and news cycles. Like, it is my job as a VC, after I make an investment, to make it so the entire world knows about that investment, right? Like, I get paid to do that beyond making the right investment and doing on that. So that the biggest issue to your point is like a lot of these 22-year-olds, they're coming out of having 10 years of only seeing Sequoia and, you know, A16Z and those stories of that one founder that got $100 million with zero revenue pre-product, and they were already valued at $1 billion before anything. And also know that a lot of these 22-year-olds are actually fundraising with the idea of is as long as I have 1% of my billion-dollar company, I'll have a big payday. But no one's talking about the fact if I own 100% of my 10 million, my 10, 20, 30 million dollar company, I'm making just as much money on an exit. That is not as sexy of the rags to riches, zero reinventing the wheel story. I think there's a huge opportunity. Like there's so much value today, especially with AI, to take old stodgy business models in verticals, putting that sexy AI into it, turning a 30% margin business into a 70% margin business. But it's not going to be a part of a sexy business. It's going to be one that's been around for the last 100 years and has been operating at razor thin margins. I mean, a lot of the businesses that you help today, like the reason why they find so much value in it is because they don't operate on super high margin business models. So every percentage point is a huge dial mover for them at the end of the year. But these are business models that have the opportunity of scaling. And that's why you hear about all these millennials buying up laundromats and being like, oh, I'll put a coffee shop in it. And like, switch up the business model a bit. That is $1 million a year business with the right margin. You can make $500,000 a year. Again, not talking about that in venture.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess also like culturally, I would be curious, like from your standpoint, basically I have a bunch of quotes that you said to me the last time we met that I just want to ask you about, which one of them is you said hire fast, fire fast, but it's not about being ruthless. It's about maintaining excellence. We love that. So what does a strong culture look like in your world, especially as you are scaling and you are scaling globally?
Yeah, strong culture, I mean, it starts with basic values. And I love when people think our values respect. Well, obviously, everybody should respect each other, but that's not a value, right? Like values should be actionable. They should be a true actionable thing. So like our values are get shit done right, catch up, own it, believe the genie and class shines. And those all have very specific paragraphs underneath them that mean something. And to do that, not only do we talk about it, we say that we hire and fire based on our values. The rest of the team does as well. So we have a kudos chat where people call out each other like, hey, I'm going to give Nicole kudos today because she really embodied the value of ketchup. Let me tell you what she did. We also do fuck up of the month. And it's a meeting that happens once a month where it's fuck up of the month. And everybody gets to get up and tell us where they fucked up. And
I like that.
It takes a lot of ownership, but also you have to fail and you have to fail fast. If we're going to grow, we're going to need a lot of people to fail. And you're allowed to fail. You just need to do it quickly and let's get, you know, get it over with. Let's find the next failure. So I think culture is really about that. And when you keep building that, what ends up happening now is I'm not the person who's making the culture happen. I will get people on my team coming and being like, hey, I don't think this person's a good fit because they're not excellent. And let me tell you why. And it's like, okay, well, let's bring that person in. We're not going to do this behind the scenes. Let's have that conversation. Let's do it openly. And when you do things so openly and so transparently, most people who don't feel like they fit will just say, look, this is not for me. And it's, again, not about being ruthless, but it's not the right bus for everybody. We're a small, fast-moving, hyper-growth company, and that takes a certain type of individual, and that's okay. And if that's not you, it's totally fine. You might be excellent someplace else. You may just not be excellent here. But I want you to be able to look to your right and left and be like, oh my God, that person's so freaking smart. I got to be as smart as that guy. And if you feel that, instead of being like, wow, that person's been here for longer than me, makes more than me, and they really suck. Like, I don't want that.
Yeah. I mean,
right on.
I think we are, it's necessary. Drew, when we were in San Francisco and we were at Visa's offices and doing that talk, and you said something on stage, and it was like something I remember. I think I was the only person in the audience. I was like, woo! And because I just fundamentally believed in it, but it was like, soon every business is just going to be like a business hiring more businesses or something like that. Like there's not just the one pathway for like an employee to have their salary or wealth or help me out.
Yeah. I mean, what I was talking about is actually I was talking about individuals, and every single individual will ultimately have multiple jobs. And the real thing that we're underwriting here, it's like, have as many, take advantage of as many opportunities as you can. But at the same time, every single job you do, you have to make it so you're doing 100% of it for yourself. But I said, you need to be optimizing to create your full-time salary in any way you need to live the life you want to live. And sometimes that is someone having one job for $50,000, another one for $150,000, and another one that pays you an extra $10,000. But I mean, I think that is just generally important, is like you should create your own future of work. And if that is one job or 20 jobs, that's up to you. But to me, everyone should be kind of leaning into a multitude of different job opportunities. And that is the future. I think all of us, we all have our little side things. Some of them we monetize. Other ones, we just want to spend time with our kids, whatever it may be. But if you want to monetize, you want to monetize. One thing I do want to just go back to what you said is, which I think is interesting, from the fact I run a growth marketing agency, and me and my co-founder bootstrapped that. And, you know, Nicole's bootstrapped her business as well. When I have team members messing up, I feel like it hits me very different versus me doing it on the backs of whatever $100 million round from a VC. It is my money in a very personal way. I'm curious, how do you feel like your relationship is with building your business, managing folks, firing folks, hiring folks, when it's coming off of a balance sheet that, like, ultimately, if it's not going to them, it could technically be going to you?
Yeah, I would say that I think it absolutely hits different.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes good founders, right? Because it hits different, because that passion is so important. Like, for the three of us, if something happens in the business, like, you care so much,
deeply.
So deeply. And it's like, there's so much more I could have done. But I think that, like, post-mortem is also really important, right? And I think that's why, like, those mistakes and, like, allowing people to have space to make mistakes. And I'm not saying huge ones, although we've had some really bad fuck-ups of the months. We had a fuck-up of the year last year that was...
Of the year?
We had a fuck-up of the year. Yeah, it was crowned.
Was that at a meeting?
It was at a meeting. Well, no, I actually gave an award for it. I gave an award for fuck-up of the year. We had one of our...
God. This is like The Office.
Yeah, we had one of our entry-level SDRs come in, and she thought she was on a demo account, and she wasn't. And she clicked a button and changed the settings for 3,500 customers in one click. And she came into my office almost shaking, crying, and she owned it. And she told me what happened, and we fixed it. It was really hard, but we fixed it. And, you know, ultimately it was our fault, because, like, how does an entry-level SDR have the ability to do that? How was that vulnerability? How did that even exist, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, how did we not train this person right? Like, there were so many learnings that came from that. And the reason I think that transparent fuck-up culture is so important is that had I not done that, potentially we wouldn't have known for, like, a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Yeah, there would have been, like, the hiding.
It would have been, like, hiding. And exactly.
Yeah.
But because we have this culture of, like, yo, own it and we'll have your back. Mm-hmm. Like, just own it. If you don't tell me, like, you tell your kids all the time, right? Like, tell me the truth and I will help you. But if you don't, sorry, like, I have no room for that. I think that helps a lot. I mean, like, look, she's been promoted 3 times in that. She's one of our top employees. And literally last year, I was like, what do we do right now? So I think that's why that failure is important. And it's not that it doesn't hurt you or doesn't hurt your balance sheet, but people are going to fuck up anyway. They're going to mess up anyway. Mistakes are going to happen. You're going to make mistakes. But if you can solve them in real time quickly by creating a culture of full transparency, then I think it just, you know, makes you fail faster and fail forward.
Love that.
I mean, it's being a first time and early founder, I love the owning of your fuck ups. On the other side of that, I think there can be some, I think what can be hard about being the founder is that no one else is on your team is as, like, obsessed with what you're doing and your vision as you are, and you really can't necessarily expect them to, you know. And I think for me that has been something a little bit harder. I'm like
lonely at the top.
I'm like, what do you mean? Are you not as obsessed with this thing as I am? No, but obviously, like, it makes sense. They have other things, other lives, right? Other side gigs, other, like, and I think that's why that your quote resonated with me and that future of work element. So I'm, you know, curious. So yes, you do fuck up of the month, fuck up of the year. I love that. So that makes them own their failures. I guess, how do you think about that, getting them to own more of the bigger vision of what you're doing and being really bought into that, and it not feeling like just another job that's a salary that's...
I think vision is only bought into if it's talked about consistently.
Okay.
And all the time, and it should be very simple, right? So there's a story about JFK going to NASA and asking everybody, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? And everybody's answer was, I'm going to get a man to the moon. I'm going to get a man to the moon. Aww. And he stopped and asked the custodian, like, what do you do here? And he's like, well, I clean the floors to make sure that no one astronaut slips so I can get a man to the moon. And that's true vision, right? Yes. Like, that is a story of vision. Because vision should be one or two sentences. It should be something that everybody can align to and everybody can see their piece and how that piece makes a difference to the long-term vision. They're never going to own every piece that you do. They're never going to hold the bag as heavily as you will. But they will be able to own it. And that ownership of like what they're doing makes them so proud of their work. And exactly. They're part of a much bigger mission and vision. And all of that, I think, is what builds careers.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And then can spark that ownership mentality can spark more ideas, right? Can help you with your blind spots, can do so many things. So I'm working on it. That's like it's a thing. That's all right. I know we have just a few minutes here left, so I want to ask what your biggest maverick move do you think has ever been? If you could just distill everything that you've learned,
saying no. And there's a really one that happened last year that was, I don't know, like that was one of probably the ballsiest move I've ever made in my life. We were negotiating a contract with a very, very, very large bank. And we had done everything, a year of diligence and just all kinds of things. And it was almost at the finish line. And some of the things that they were saying just made no sense. Like, we were ready to launch. And I was like, this doesn't, contract signed, everything's ready to go, ready to launch. I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, and I had to call and say, sorry, we're just not going to do this. And it hurt. And I was like, oh my God. But like the way that they were proposing that we would do business would have crippled us and we wouldn't have been able to manage it. We wouldn't have been able to sustain it. And it would have been terrible on our reputation. And so I literally had to say, I'm sorry, we are not going to market this way. We are going to stop the launch. I don't care if we have to move it 4 months. I don't care if we have to cancel it altogether, but we're not going to do that. And I had to have this conversation multiple times with multiple levels of hierarchy. And ended up that we moved the launch back by 3 months and we had a whiteboard session with the entire executive team and we figured it out. And guess what? They're one of our top partners and everything works out just fine. But that no was really hard. And I think learning to say no, like when your spidey sense goes off that something's not working, like that maverick move is just say no. Like, you know your business better than anybody else. Say no.
I think that's incredible, incredible like feedback for anybody that is in business. But I also know that you've learned to say no, just like I'm sure all of us at the table learned how to say no because we've failed at saying no so many times in our career. So I'm curious, like, what advice would you give that younger individual that is trying to find that courage?
Yeah, I would say the most important thing is like understand the priority. Like if you say no, if you say yes to this, what else do you have to say no to? Mm-hmm. And understanding just where it falls, right? Like we all have to prioritize every day. There's 10 million things you have to get done. And understanding like the time is the only thing you're not going to get back. Like time is the only thing that once you spend it, it's gone.
Yeah.
That's it. So if you prioritize your time and if you prioritize your time based on things like revenue and other metrics, it gets a lot easier to say no. But yes, I've definitely said yes to far too many things that I should have said no to causes us sleepless nights. And we're like, how many flights have we been on that we're like, why am I doing this? I should have just said no.
I know how many times I'm like getting dressed and putting my lipstick on. Like, what am I doing? Why?
What's my end goal?
What was I thinking? Why did I say yes to this? Yeah, I would say I've learned how to say no a lot this year as the younger founder here. It works. It's been helpful. Well, it's the amount of other doors that open because my energy is somewhere else. And you know, thinking more like, look, I did my time. Like, I did the free thing. Like I've done the yes to everything. I've like stretched. I still stretch myself way thin, but like I do sleep, you know, a lot more than before. Yeah. and take care of myself a lot more than before. So yeah, right. So it's, I think it comes with time, like experience.
Takes reps.
You know, yeah, reps. Absolutely. Muscle takes reps. Like you have to feel almost ready for it.
And it's
but
scary.
I know, but I do wish we got there faster. I think almost every like generation kind of gets there a little bit faster. All right, so one piece of advice you wish every founder building right now understood.
One piece of advice. You're the founder, you're the visionary for a reason. Everyone isn't built like you for a reason. Mm-hmm. And like you need to own that space. You're going to hear a million no's. You're going to hear people telling you that your idea is dumb or what you're doing makes no sense or you're never going to have revenue, but you're in your seat for a reason. And just like stay true to it and just do it. Like just do the things. And perfection can often be the enemy of good. So don't wait till things are perfect. Just take the leap and do all the things because you're there for a reason.
Yeah, no, love that. And last question for you, for me at least. The one small thing every founder could do tomorrow to build for longevity instead of burnout.
This is going to sound silly, but a personal SWOT analysis.
Oh, yeah?
Every founder should be doing a personal SWOT analysis every 6 months, figure out what your opportunities are, where you want to be, and actually build a plan around that. And that should be that is your zone of genius. Stay in your zone of genius and like completely monetize that zone of genius. Optimize it. Be hyper aware. Mm.
By a personal one, do you mean just for you?
Just like, for you, like me, your own Karina. Personal, me, my, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? Okay. What are my opportunities? What are my threats? And stop doing the things that you suck at or you hate. Just stop doing them, right? Like if someone told me to be an accountant, I'd be like, I'm just really bad at that. And that's hard to say. It's hard to say that I'm not good at something. It's, you know, we're founders. We should be good at everything. But yeah. Do the things you're good at. Be in your zone of genius and you'll hyper growth yourself into ways that you don't even know.
Yeah.
I guess my last question to follow up on that is, what is your superpower?
My superpower, I think it's building relationships. I love building relationships and solving really complicated problems. Like, I love that. When it gets down to the nitty-gritty, I'm like, eh. But, like, the really big, complicated problems, I freaking love that. And I love building relationships with people to help them do that.
What? Yeah. Well, then you're in the right place. That's all we do all day, huh? Right? Yeah, we're like, absolutely. Yeah, big vision, big complex problems. Must have the right. Well, I mean, because it's, I mean, if there's anything I've learned being in this space is that it is all about that community. It's like that. I know it feels like cheesy to be like the ecosystem, but it's true. Like
absolutely.
To me, the definition of community is shared resources. So what are we doing? Like, what are we doing to make sure that we're all of our, you know, a lot of us have complementary businesses or, you know, have the certain, you know, strengths or weaknesses and, how are you putting the puzzle pieces together so that it works, right? Yeah.
Surrounding yourselves with all the things where you don't, if it's my weakness, let me find 10 people who's their strength.
Yeah.
And let me surround myself with them so that, you know?
No, and I think you can do it in ways that, like, aren't necessarily so traditional. Like, even as, like, early as I am, I tried to do more things to, like, get things off my plate from my business. And I have done some of that. But I think for me, one of the greatest hacks I've ever done was start to offload my life stuff. So I, in this early, you know, in this two-year-old phase, am just 100% fully locked in with Fintech is Femme, right? Like, okay, someone else figure out laundry, my food, like figure out food, all of that, right? And because, I mean, me and my husband are co-founders of our business. So it's like, we need to be locked in. I cannot that even offloading the life stuff. And I don't think we think of that all the time.
Yeah. And again, that goes back to zone of genius. Like, it's not my zone of genius to be a cook. Like, it's just not. I know my family needs to get fed. I know my kids, my husband need to get fed, but it's just not my zone of genius. And like, me having anxiety and worrying about this is probably going to take away from something else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh my goodness. Well,
I'm going to offload more shit. You guys,
what are you doing?
No. No, but seriously though, like my superpower is really lives in the 0 to 1. And so, you know, I have a lot of people that I brought on my team that really help maintain and scale the business. But like anything that we're like turnkeying, I'm like, get out of my way. Let me go 0 to 1. And like, I can do a lot with 0 to 1. But once we start getting to 2 to 3 to 4, that's when my superpower starts diminishing quite a bit. And so like, don't get me wrong, I can do it. And we've all had to do things we're good at. But as you become more mature in the business, then you do. You just have to relinquish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. Wow. Wait. Your superpower was relationship.
And complex problems.
And complex problems. You said
0 to 1.
0 to 1.
Yeah.
That's nice.
That's yours.
I know. I'm like, okay. I mean, storytelling, I would say. Connecting the dots, I guess. Yeah, I guess I'm
absolutely
ultimately a...
It's perfect for a good venture-backed business. Let's go raise $100 million on zero revenue.
Agreed.
We'll send the clip in.
Oh my God, I love it. All right. Well, Gariba, this has been so wonderful sitting down and hearing your lessons, learning more about Billie Jeanie. Obviously, I've been a fan and I've written about you at the newsletter. So excited to have you finally on the pod. We've talked about this for some time. So you are just clearly showing us proof that fintech doesn't just have to chase the hype to make an impact, to scale big and think big and solve complex problems. But really, innovation lives in the consistency, the clarity, and the courage to just do it your own way and not follow the whatever playbook is out there, because there's so many different ways to succeed. So thank you so much for joining us for Fintech Mavericks live at Money 2020. And to everyone listening, remember to like and subscribe to the Fintech Mavericks podcast if you haven't yet. We are found everywhere you get your podcasts. So thank you.